covered with clay. A paste of it had begun to dry and crack on his face. He cupped his hands in the creek and emptied the water over his head again and again. Then he stood and turned from everything he knew, and the four of them began to make their way into the dark Shawamigan. Part 4. Shawamigan. Flight. Thin remnants of moonlight permeated the woods. Sweet fern arced throat high over the old logging path, cloaking blackberry canes hidden like saw blades in sheaths. Spray of dark sumac. Shafts of birch and aspen faintly luminescing. Overhead, a pale and narrowing crack divided the forest canopy, marking their way more clearly than any earthly thing. For fear of jutting branches, he held his hands across his face and let the blackberry thorns rip his clothes. Now and then he stopped and clapped for the dogs. They came and snuffled nose and lip against his palm and vanished again, so sure in the dark. He paused, peered after them. Shadow upon shadow, all of it. He swung his foot forward and began again. All around, fireflies glowed their radium bellies. The voices calling after them had long since faded into the creak of tree trunks, flexing in the night breeze like the timbers of a vast ship. They hadn't circled. He couldn't have said how he knew. The direction of the wind, perhaps, or the westering cast of the moonlight. When a stand of birches glowed blue, where he expected a gap, he understood the path had fizzled out, or they'd lost it. After a time, he came upon the dogs, bunched and waiting. He counted noses, then moved his hands about in the dark, trying to understand why they'd stopped. His fingers brushed a wire, barbed and rusted, and a weather-split fence post. He slid his hands down the knotted wood until he'd located the bottom strand of wire. Then he sidestepped away from the fence post, bent over, and tracing the barbs loosely with his fingers. He stopped when there was enough slack to haul the wire up. He clapped twice and the dogs came forward. By touch, he moved them under the wire. Essay first, he guessed, then Tinder, then Babu. They were panting and hot as they went. He rolled under last of all and stood and pointlessly brushed off his clothes, wet and hanging on him like sheets of wax. He looked up. Islands of stars and a lake of black, the forest spectral and pathless all around. He set off in a direction he hoped was west. Hours of the night passed. He stopped when the woods opened onto a glade. The moon was high and bright, and before him the charcoal skeletons of trees rose from blue marsh grass. He blinked at the excess moonlight in the clearing and clapped for the dogs. High in the crown of a charred tree, an owl revolved its dished face, and one branch down, three small replicas followed. Babu came at once. Tinder had begun pushing into the tall grass, and he turned and trotted back. Edgar clapped again and waited. When Essay didn't appear, he led Tinder and Babu into the trees and touched his hand to the ground. The dogs circled and downed. He paced a few steps away and unzipped his pants. His urine seemed to take with it all the warmth in his body. He peeled off his wet shirt and jeans and hung them on a branch and stood there in the night, clad only in underpants. Clammy as they were, he couldn't bring himself to take them off. He walked back and lay next to Babu. Babu raised his head and looked at Edgar's arm draped across his chest and laid his head down again. When they were all settled, Essay stepped out of a deer track in the sedge. She sniffed the three of them and walked to the clearing's edge and peered upward and returned and stood panting until Edgar sat up and set his hand on her croup. She downed and tucked against his back, grunting with what sounded like disapproval. One after another, the dogs heaved sighs and pressed their heads tight to their sides. Edgar lay watching the silhouettes of the owls warp as they scanned the clearing. He wondered if they should have pushed on until they came to water for the dogs. But after so many hours of stilted, cautious movement in the dark, a crashing weariness had come over him. And yet the moment his eyes closed, there lay Dr. Papineau at the bottom of the Mao stairs. Edgar gasped and opened his eyes. "You're a murderer," he said to himself. "You get what you get." The next instant, he was asleep. When he woke, the dogs were standing above him like nurses, puzzling over a patient, sighting along their muzzles and cocking their heads. The ground beside him was still warm from their bodies. He unclasped his hands from between his knees and pushed himself upright. The dogs bucked and wheeled. Essay planted her back feet and walked out her front until the cords quivered in her sides. Babu and Tinder yawned out soft creaks from gaping mouths. The owls were gone. Across the glade, the treetops glowed carmine where the rising sun touched them. His head throbbed. He thought they couldn't have slept more than 2 hours. He sat, arms around his knees, until the unfurling weeds began to tickle his nether parts. He fetched his trousers from the branch where they hung. They were as wet as when he'd taken them off, and now cold. He lifted a foot, then stopped and peered down the leg holes. When he'd finished dressing, he thought he might as well have clothed himself in wilted lettuce. Babu had stayed beside him, but Essay and Tinder had already slipped into the tall grass, hunting each other. Trails of grass shook, and they dove into the clear and wheeled and plunged back in. He stroked Babu's neck and watched. The dogs had filled out in the last few months. Their chests were thick and deep, their backs broad, and they moved with a powerful leonine grace. He clapped his hands. The grass stopped moving, and Tinder and Essay cantered out. He sat them in a row and paced backward and recalled them one by one. They repeated this 3 times. Then he snapped off a dead tree branch and rolled it between his palms to scent it up and had them each fetch it. They practiced downs and rollovers and crawls while the birds around the edge of the clearing chattered. They were heated up then, even lackadaisical Babu. He thought they'd better find water. His nighttime fretting seemed pointless. No creek could be far off in the lower Shawamayan. He looked back along the way they'd come. Then he led them around the perimeter of the clearing and picked a spot and set foot in the forest again. After half an hour, they descended a shallow, alder-choked ravine that bottomed out in a creek 6 inches deep and filled with pale green grass, laid over in the current like mermaid hair. The dogs began to lap at once. Edgar tossed his shoes and socks across and waded in and scooped up a handful of water that tasted like cold, weak tea. He let the water run over his feet until the dogs climbed out and sprawled near a mossy log. And then they moved on. The slant of the morning sunlight made it easy to keep his bearings. They were traversing the ridges west of the kennel, ridges he and Almandine had gazed over countless times as they sat on the hill in the south field. He didn't know how far the ridges went or what they gave on to. They'd seldom traveled that direction. That old life, suddenly so remote, had been oriented along the meridian of Highway 13, with Ashland to the north and everything else, Wausau, Madison, Milwaukee, Chicago, to the south. So he gave himself just 2 rules, stay off the roads and travel west. Whenever he was forced to detour around an obstacle, he chose the northernmost alternative. Beyond that, he had no specific destination or design, no more than when he'd first begun training the dogs on those odds and ends in the Mao. He wanted distance from that prior life. He wanted time, later, to think about what had happened and what to do about it. Until then, he wanted to think about the 4 of them and how they should move. He was already beginning to worry about the dogs. He didn't know what to do about food. He didn't even have a pocket knife. Despite himself, he wondered what was happening at the kennel. He thought about Almandine. how he hadn't had a chance to make amends with her. He wondered where she'd slept without him in the house. He wondered if his mother was standing behind the silo that morning, signaling him to return. Perhaps they were still walking through the woods, shouting his name. The thought gave him twinges of both satisfaction and remorse. The jolt of his mother's slap kept coming back to him, and a furious expression. And Dr. Papineau's eyes, the life dimming in them as he watched. His resolve wasn't tested until late that morning, when they came to a road cutting through the forest. It was barely more than a dirt track strewn with gravel and overhung on both sides by trees, so desolate he felt no qualms about standing in the middle of it. The sun was almost at its zenith. He squinted both directions for mailboxes or stop signs. There was nothing, not even telephone poles, just washboards ribbed into the dirt. The long, clear line of the road was a surprisingly welcome sight, for the unceasing effort of reading the tangle of underbrush and choosing a path had begun to wear him down. Plus, mercifully, there was breeze enough in the open to dissipate the mosquitoes, which had progressed from an annoyance to a torment as he and the dogs traveled. Every fern frond and blade of grass they brushed stirred up another cloud of the hateful things. In self-defense, he'd broken into a trot, swinging his hands around his head and slapping his face and neck. But the moment he stopped, they descended again, doubly drawn to his overheated skin. He sat on the dirt, legs crossed, and gathered the dogs. An approaching car would be visible miles away, and he wanted to rest for a minute. If the traveling was hard, he thought, at least there was some consolation in watching the dogs. Back at the kennel, Essay had always been the most delinquent, the hardest to train, and the first to grow bored. But in the woods she was at ease, scouting, acting the huntress, forging ahead to challenge any oddity she found. A strangely aromatic stump, a chipmunk skittering through the leaves, a drumming grouse. When she was nearly out of sight, she'd turn to look back, though not always. Sometimes she charged into the underbrush. It made her a flagrantly inefficient traveler, covering twice as much ground as she needed to. But whenever Edgar tried to keep her nearby, she whined and dropped her ears. Babu was the steadfast one. If Edgar told him to wait, Babu waited like a stone laid upon the earth by God himself, pleased to know his job. That Babu was charmingly literal had always been clear, but in the woods he was a pragmatist. He trotted along behind Edgar as he broke trail, sometimes sticking close at Edgar's heels, sometimes dropping back. But if more than a few yards came between them, Babu crashed recklessly forward to close the gap. Of the three, Tinder was the hardest to pin down. He always stayed in sight, neither shadowing Edgar nor launching himself into the underbrush. But whenever Essay reappeared from one of her forays, it was Tinder who met her, and dropped back to touch muzzles with Babu, as if carrying news. Edgar sat in the sun in the road. To the far side was a deep patch of fern, so lush it looked primordial. They ought to get out of the open, he knew. He was still persuading himself to brave the mosquitoes when Essay's ears twitched and she turned her head. He followed her gaze. Far down the road, a tiny cloud of orange dust was rising, and a windshield heliographed as it passed in and out of the shade. He scrambled up into a crouch. The car was far away, and at first he felt no rush. If the driver had seen Edgar and the dogs at all, he had probably taken them for deer. Edgar clapped his hands, signed come, and waded into the overgrown bracken. The dogs thrashed along behind him. He dropped into the green shadow world of grass and fiddleheads and worked his way along on all fours. At the back of the thicket they came to a dense blackberry bramble, the thorns curved and sharp as scalpels. Even if he forced himself through, the dogs would balk. He chided himself for running toward the unfamiliar. He thought there was still time to cross back the way they'd come, retreat into known terrain. so they wouldn't get more than 20 yards into the forest before the car passed. Babu and Tinder were close behind, but Essay had already turned and begun to nose her way back toward the road. He stayed the two dogs. Babu dropped into a sit like a soldier, and Duck walked through the ferns and tapped Essay on the hip. She looked at him across her flank. He led her back. When she was sitting again, he raised up into a crouch and peered over the fronds. The car was closer than he expected, 100 yards away and slowing down. There was no way to cross without being seen. They were maybe 15 feet into the ferns, and they had broken a path wide enough to see the dirt of the road, but he guessed they would be hidden from a moving car. He got the dog's attention, then signed down, his hand rising briefly into the clear. The dogs eased themselves to the ground. Essay whined and tucked her hind feet under her hips, and elevated her nose in a shaft of sunlight, poking it upward in tiny saccades to take the scent. He laid one arm over Essay and reached back with the other to touch Tinder, hoping that if he could keep the two of them steady, he could count on Babu to follow their lead. The car's bumper appeared through the stems of the ferns, moving slowly. There was the pong of a stone popping from under a tire. Essay quivered beneath his hand. A white front fender passed his line of sight, then a tire, a black and white door, another tire, the rear bumper. When the car was some distance down the road, he snapped his fingers. The dogs looked at him. "Stay," he signed. He eyeballed Essay and repeated the command. "That's two stays. You better stick." He finished with one finger warningly in front of her nose. She broke into a pant and tipped her hips to the side. He raised his head out of the ferns. The car was a sheriff's cruiser covered with dust, as if it had been trolling roads all night. A lone, massive figure sat behind the wheel, arm outstretched along the top of the seat. The brake lights stuttered. Edgar dropped back down into the ferns. He counted to 100. When the only sound was the heat bugs in the noon sun, he released the dogs. They looked at him. He released them a second time, to no effect. He understood something was wrong then, and he cautiously raised his head out of the ferns a second time. The cruiser was parked 200 yards farther along. Only then could he hear it idling. The driver's side door was open, and Glenn Papineau stood looking down the road, so big he hardly seemed capable of squeezing back in. Edgar fell down into the ferns. "Stay, stay," he signed. Essay swiped her tail and tucked her feet, and Tinder pressed his muzzle against Edgar's palm with a questioning stare, but in the end both of them stayed put. It was Babu who began to rise, half in curiosity, half in confusion. Edgar clapped once, overly loud. The dog froze and looked at him through the stalks of the ferns. "Down!" he signed frantically. "Stay!" From up the road he heard Glenn Papineau's voice. "Edgar," he called. "Edgar Sawtell?" Babu lowered himself to the ground, eyes wide. They waited. Edgar heard a door slam, and then the faint rumble of the engine as the cruiser pulled away. This time they waited until he began to worry that the road was a dead end and that Glenn might double back. He left the dogs in stays and crept out to the road. There was nothing to see, not even a cloud of dust. He clapped. The dogs bounded out of the ferns and danced about him in a sort of pageant his mother called the end-of-down dance. A few yards up the road, he found a clear line into the woods, and in another minute the road had disappeared behind them, and they passed into the evanescent stipple of the forest at midday. By late afternoon, Edgar was hungry. Had been hungry, in fact, for quite some time. The final vestiges of panic from the night before had been drained by the monotony of breaking trail, and he felt lightheaded and irritable, and his stomach gnawed at him. He wondered if it was the same with the dogs. They didn't seem uneasy. They'd spent all afternoon tramping through underbrush and fording backwood streams. So far, the dogs had only missed their morning feeding, but he was used to breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and he didn't even have a match to light a fire, much less a plan to get food. He did have something in mind, though it wasn't exactly a plan, since it depended largely on chance. The woods were dotted with vacation cabins and fishing shacks. What was called the Shawamigan, as if it were a single block of forest, was in fact a Swiss cheese of government-owned forest and private property, particularly around the dozens of lakes. Sooner or later they were bound to find a cabin stocked with supplies, or come across a car with some fisherman's lunch inside. They hadn't seen one yet. He hoped that meant they were due. The problem with that idea, he thought as they reached another clearing, was that cabins and cars were located on roads, not in the middle of the woods, and roads were to be avoided at all costs. The encounter with Glenn Papineau had removed any doubt from his mind about whether anyone was searching for them. If they were spotted, even by someone driving along who later called the sheriff's office to report a boy with a bunch of dogs, they would have a good idea where he was. Cutting through the woods, however, meant slow going. He doubted they were covering more than a mile every 2 or 3 hours, with all the underbrush and marshes and the dogs to manage, and the caution with which he needed to pick his steps. A sprained ankle would be a disaster. He wondered if someone might be tracking them with dogs. The woods near the kennel would be so soaked with his scent, the fields so crisscrossed with layers of track from his ordinary daily work, that only the purest, most experienced tracking dog had any chance. And every hour that passed, their track blended farther into the general mélange. Then there was the question of where they'd find tracking dogs anyway. Sawtelle dogs would be useless. Field tracking was an art they didn't practice. He could hear his mother laugh at the idea. She would tell anyone who suggested it that they might as well track him with cows. But away from the kennel, everything changed. Their scent would be undisguised and distinctive. And between the four of them, they were laying a scent track a mile wide, as obvious to a real tracking dog as if the ground had been lit on fire. The only way to break such a trail would be to get into a vehicle, but hitchhiking with three dogs was as good as walking into the sheriff's office in Mellon, which brought him back again to staying off the roads. He was thinking about this problem, circling it and drawing out the alternatives in his mind, when through the trees he glimpsed sunlight reflecting off water. The late afternoon had grown cooler and the wind had calmed. When they reached the water, it was a lake. They walked out onto a small peninsula of sedge and cattails. The shoreline was irregular and densely forested. He scanned for cabins, but all he saw were pines making a sawtooth pattern against the sky and birds diving over the lake, sweeping up insects. Mosquitoes, he fervently hoped. The dogs walked to the water's edge. Having spent no time at lakes, they reared and jumped at the small waves that washed up onto their feet. They would have to go around the lake one way or another. Because he could see most of the shoreline to the north, he chose that direction. In the twilight, they came upon a snapping turtle, the size of a dinner plate, marching toward the water. The dogs gathered around it, rearing as it turned its blunt head, jaws agape and hissing. He rushed over and shooed them away, thinking of the stories he'd heard of turtles' jaws staying locked onto whatever they'd bitten, even after their heads were cut off. He kept his own feet well back from the thing. He didn't want to find out if the stories were true. As soon as the dogs abandoned the turtle, Tinder wheeled and backtracked along its path, then began to whine and dig. In a moment, the other dogs joined in, and dirt was flying through the air. They were gobbling the turtle's eggs, teeth clicking, when Edgar got there. He reached past them and picked up an egg. It was cool and soft in his hand, the size and texture of a leathery ping-pong ball. Looking at it, his stomach did a traitorous little flip. Before his mouth could water any more, he took 3 additional eggs from the rapidly diminishing pile and brushed the dirt off them. When Babu looked up, he tossed one back. The dog snatched it from the air. Edgar tucked the other 3 in his shirt pocket. It bothered him to see them eating like that, but he had nothing better to offer. When they could find no more eggs, he slapped his leg and turned to pick a place to sleep while there was still some light. He chose a spot under a stand of ash near the water. The sky overhead was a deep cobalt. Suddenly, he was bone-tired. He walked the 4 of them out to the lake and let them drink, and slipped off his shoes and rolled up his jeans and waded in. His feet stirred up silt in the water, and he had to reach far out, overbalancing himself, to ladle up anything clear. Even then it tasted of algae and muck and left grit between his teeth. He drank again. He led the dogs back, carrying his shoes and socks. They curled up at once. He tried to lie between them, but a rock poked his ribs. His clothes had dried during the day, but they felt greasy and lax, and his stomach was bloated with water. He thought he might gag if he dwelt on its taste. Hunger twisted inside him. He got up and found a better position, though he could reach only Esse. Babu stood, grumbling as if to say, "Oh, all right," and moved over and circled twice and settled with his muzzle near Edgar's face. Shortly, Tinder followed. He woke sometime in the night. The dogs lay curled about him in circles of slumber, and somewhere a nightingale was calling, "Old Sam Peabody, Peabody, Peabody." Whatever had roused him had been in his dreams. And then he remembered. He was in the air above the workshop stairs, and he was falling, falling. Sunrise. Clamor and screech of birds, as if the sunlight had set them afire. The dogs stretched where they lay. Immediately he was thinking about food. His belly felt curdled, and a coppery tang coated his teeth as if the minerals in the ground had seeped into him. By the time he sat up, the dogs were snooping in the undergrowth. He called them over one at a time and felt for stickers and burrs, starting with their tails and moving toward their heads. They lay chewing their forelegs as if pulling kernels off a corn cob as he worked. Occasionally they nuzzled his hands, objecting to some pinch or tug. Then he stayed the dogs and walked each of them out and trotted back and signed a release. When they returned, he reached into his shirt pocket and produced a turtle egg. Tinder first, then Babu. Esse went last, a vain attempt to teach her patience. Having watched the others get their reward, she streaked toward him through the woods the instant he moved his hands. Then they set out again, keeping the lake to their left. The underbrush was sparse compared to the previous day's travel, and they made good time. The morning air was thick with moisture, and the grasses shed water droplets that glistened on the dogs' coats. When they'd rounded the lake halfway, he could see water stretching away in a jagged meander to the south. He was fretting over the problem of food when he glimpsed the first cabin. The sight of it did nothing to ease his mind. He stayed the dogs and walked forward until he understood it couldn't possibly be occupied. They walked out of the brush together to inspect it. The little shack had collapsed inward many years before. If it had ever been painted, the paint had long since washed into the earth, and now only the roofing shingles, bright purple, hadn't grayed. A scabrous folding chair stood on what remained of the crude front porch, shedding paint flakes the color of dried mustard, as rust worked its way underneath. Inside was a calamity of plywood and mossy bedsprings, and vast spider webs hanging like spinnakers between the timbers. The whole thing covered no more ground than a good-sized tent, 10 feet on a side. The dogs circled and poked their noses into crannies and corners until he called them away for fear of rats and snakes. An hour later, they came to a place at the water's edge, where the riotous undergrowth gave way to a small crescent of gravelly sand. Further out, reeds projected through the silver surface. He stripped off his clothes and parted the dogs and waded in. The water was brown with tannin. He was covered with mosquito bites, and the cool hug of liquid soothed the itching. He looked down to see a panfish darting between his knees. The dogs stood watching and wagging their tails, but wouldn't come in the water. He emerged naked and knee-deep, splashing the dogs. They dashed away and back again, ears laid low, crouching and scrambling to dodge the spray, remembering, perhaps, games they'd played in the yard with the garden hose. Part of him was glad he'd found something that pleased them, but he quickly stopped. In himself he felt nothing but gloom, and the play seemed false, a pretense that everything was going to be okay. Besides, he began to worry about working them up. That wasn't right, not until they got real food. Already they looked thinner to him, though that was probably his imagination. They were acting a little too wild, their hunger making them frantic. They stood panting and watching as he swept beads of water off his legs. In a minute or two, the sun had dried him enough to dress. This time he flapped his trousers out and looked down the legs and knocked his shoes against his hand without a second thought. The next cabin looked more promising. It was painted a utilitarian green, but it was sturdy and well-maintained. A galvanized smokestack pierced its sloped roof. A pair of small windows were set high off the ground on either side of the door. It was so tidy, in fact, he watched it for a while, before he was sure it was unoccupied. Even then, his skin tingled as he approached. The door was held shut by a padlock threaded through a heavy metal latch. The padlock had been slathered with grease and wrapped with a plastic bag, presumably to protect it against the elements. He turned the knob and tried a few hard pushes. Then he backed up and took a running start and hit it. He bounced off. He tried again. The structure shook, but the door didn't budge in its frame. And his shoulder began to hurt. The dogs stood and cocked their heads. "It works on TV," he signed. "Shut up." He looked at the windows again. They were three-paned, top-hinged transom windows, set about 6 feet off the ground. Big enough to fit through, he thought, and he could easily break the glass. But it seemed unlikely he could heft himself through without cutting himself to ribbons. And while he'd been throwing himself at the door, it had occurred to him that it would be best to enter without being obvious. He searched the surrounds for a log, or anything that might serve as a boost. To know whether it was worth breaking the window and help him climb through if it was. But he found nothing useful. He looked for a likely spot to hide a key. Nothing again. He walked to the front of the cabin and looked at the dogs. "We're going back for that chair," he signed. And they set off the way they'd come. He didn't realize how far they would have to backtrack. It took over an hour before he glimpsed the purple shingles again. He grabbed his stick and swept the cobwebs from the chair and yanked it off the porch. Half a dozen spiders scrambled away like rotted berries on legs. The web straps that had formed the seat hung in brown tatters, but the frame itself seemed solid, if rusty. Babu nosed it curiously. Esse and Tinder lay down. All three dogs had kept their noses to the ground on their return, no doubt hoping for more turtle eggs. More than once they had bolted after squirrels gibbering in the underbrush before learning it was a waste of time. Now they were acting dispirited, and a stab of anxiety entered his chest. When they passed the little beach on their return, he was so eager he started jogging along. He set the chair frame beneath one of the transom windows, and he was about to hoist himself up when he checked the impulse and decided to test the chair first. He planted his rump on the arm. One of the crusty front legs crumpled like a paper soda straw. He looked at it in surprise, then flipped the chair over and pressed both hands onto the joint where the back and the seat came together. Satisfied, he stepped onto the frame and put his fingertips on the windowsill. During the walk back, he had allowed himself to imagine how a fisherman might stock such a neatly kept shack with all sorts of canned goods and tackle. But his view through the window revealed only a bare cot folded against one plywood wall, a prefab fireplace at the base of the galvanized chimney, and a small kerosene stove and a lantern. There was no point trying to get in. It was obvious he'd find no food. And even if the lantern had fuel, which he doubted, it would burn for only a few hours. The camp stove was too unwieldy to carry. He hopped to the ground. He sat beside the crippled chair and chastised himself. A good fisherman would never leave food to lure animals. He should have known that. But instead he talked himself into a fantasy. They'd wasted the better part of the day on a pointless errand. He was so hungry now, his insides spasmed. His mouth had watered as soon as the cabin came into view. He'd read somewhere that a person could live for a month without food, but that seemed impossible. Perhaps if the person sat in one place and did nothing, but not if they were crossing miles of unpathed forest. It was too much. With all that had happened at the kennel, and now the hunger and the worry about the dogs, and suddenly without Almandine there, it felt like some organ had been ripped from his insides. He brought his knees to his chest and lay over on his side. He thought he was going to cry, but instead his mind emptied, and he lay staring along the roots and leaves of the forest floor and listened to the far-off sound of the dogs rattling through the underbrush. He stayed like that for a long time. Eventually, the dogs returned, Babu first, then Tinder and Esse. They panted and licked his face and stretched out around him, grunting and sighing, and finally sleeping. His malaise didn't entirely pass, but it did lighten, and he sat up and looked around. In the distance, a prop plane sputtered. A flock of small black birds with obsidian beaks cackled warnings at one another from lower branches of the trees. He forced himself to stand, and the dogs assembled around him, nuzzling his hands for food. He knelt and stroked their ruffs. "I don't have anything," he sighed. "I'm sorry. I don't even know when I will." They walked the lakeshore. In a clearing, he spotted a lone, ripe blueberry hanging from a bush. Too early in the season, but there it was. He didn't think it was nightshade, but he turned over the leaves to check. The blueberry patch covered a circle of 30 feet or so, and from it he harvested a single handful of ripe berries. He tasted one, then squatted and held them out. The dog sniffed his bounty and walked away. "No, try them," he signed. "Come back." But they wouldn't. As soon as he swallowed them, his stomach began to churn. For a moment he thought he might vomit, but he didn't. At dusk, he picked a spot to bed down among a grove of maples. They were settled and half asleep when a high, thin whine swelled in the treetops, then hovered downward until it seethed all around them. When he looked at his arm, it was covered in undulating gray fur. He swiped a hand from elbow to wrist, leaving behind a mash of blood and crushed mosquitoes. At once, a rapacious new layer appeared in the slime. Mosquitoes began crawling in his nostrils and ears. The dogs leapt up and snapped at the air, and Edgar waved his arms and slapped his neck and face. But in the end, they ran and ran, the dogs disappearing ahead into the gloom. After a while he halted, gasping and disoriented. The forest floor was covered with a layer of pine needles thick enough to choke the underbrush. He listened for the mosquitoes, shuddering. A cloud of them had waited in the forest canopy, and he and the dogs had lain willingly beneath. He'd never heard of such a thing. The dogs trotted out of the gloaming, and they made their beds on the pine needles. He lay looking into the treetops. He was hungry, tired, dejected, and now humiliated. The stomachs of the dogs gurgled as they lay around him. They were going to have to find a road after all, he thought, or they would starve. By the third day, he was doing the math continually. The dogs had eaten nothing but turtle eggs for 2 days. He'd eaten maybe 30 blueberries. One moment he told himself it wasn't a disaster to miss 6 meals. The next moment his stomach pulsed and contracted. Squirrels and birds were everywhere, but he had no idea how to catch one. The lakes were probably brimming with fish, but he didn't have a single inch of monofilament line, much less a hook. They heard the moan of tires along the blacktop half an hour before they reached the road. From behind a balsam, they watched a ragged procession of cars pass, then snuck to the embankment and bolted into the woods on the far side, and began following the highway as they'd followed the shoreline the day before, staying well hidden in the forest. Twice, streams too deep or marshy forced them back to the road to wait and dash across a bridge before they could move on. In the afternoon, they came to a field of sedge and chokecherry, about a quarter of a mile wide and several hundred yards deep. Halfway to the back tree line, Edgar stopped and looked at the road. On the one hand, they would be exposed if they crossed there, but on the other, he was starting to tire, and it was a significant shortcut. The grass was tall enough to hide the dogs. He could duck if a car appeared. They'd crossed halfway when something chittered through the grass and Tinder leapt after it and the other dogs after Tinder. Edgar caught up with them dancing around a burrow entrance. Out on the road, a car was approaching. He dropped to all fours and waited. For some time, the faraway burr of a small airplane had been swelling and fading. When it began to swell again, he craned his neck and looked up. He saw nothing against the blue sky. The burr grew louder, and then louder still. The moment the car passed, he clapped the dogs out of their stays and bolted. By the time he dove into the birch on the far side of the clearing, he could almost hear the individual cylinders firing in the airplane engine. The dogs had stuck close by him for once, and he huddled them up beneath a dogwood. When the airplane passed over, it was so low he could read the Forest Service insignia. "Idiot," he thought. "You're going to stay in the woods." They kept hidden there for the better part of an hour, tracking the sound of the airplane as it progressed north and south along its search pattern. After he got the dogs moving again, he kept them strictly under tree cover, circling even the smallest glades. Mid-afternoon, they came to a gravel road tightly enclosed by pine forest. There were power lines strung along on creosoted poles. A few hundred yards east, the road intersected the blacktop. They tracked it in the opposite direction, staying back in the woods. The dogs had begun moving with their tails down, edgy and wild-looking. 70 hours, said the counting part of his brain. One turtle egg for every 4 hours. One blueberry an hour for him. Half a blueberry. They watched a station wagon rumble by with its backwash of brown dust. They walked to the tree line. Ahead, where the road curved, he saw the first cabin and the lake glittering behind it. Then all the other cabins nestled among the trees. Posts with reflectors marking the driveways. Over the lash of waves against the lakeshore, he heard a boat motor sputtering and the cry of sandpipers and inland gulls. The station wagon had rounded the curve and driven on. He led the dogs along until they were across from the nearest cabin. No car in the grassy drive. The dogs knew something was happening, and they circled and poked one another with their muzzles and hopped ticklishly. "Down," he signed. They whined but complied, one after another. "Stay," he signed. "Stay." He'd slipped into bad habits already, he thought. Repeating commands was minor, failing to trust them far worse. He forced himself not to repeat the stay a third time, and walked out to the road and looked back. The dogs lay panting in the forest shade, watching him. He turned and walked up the cabin driveway, trying to look as if he belonged there. This was no fisherman's shack. A window sash had been raised, curtains ruffled in the breeze behind the screen. A formica table sat beneath a window, covered with folded newspaper and a scattering of mail. Ceramic cows labeled S and P curtsied to one another. Beyond, he saw a kitchen with plain cupboards and an icebox and a stove. The counter was strewn with cellophaned packages, cookies, potato chips, loaves of bread. His hands were shaking now. He tried the front door, but it was locked. He returned to the window. At the back of the cabin was a screen door, latched with a hook and eye. He rattled the door. The hook wouldn't shake loose. He turned to look around. No one sunbathed on the beach. No one swam off the dock. He trotted into the nearby woods and came back with a short, blunt stick, and he punched a neat line of screening away from the center bar of the door and threaded his arm through and popped the hook and swung the door open. He stepped over the jumble of toys on the living room floor, and then he was in the kitchen, throwing open the cupboards. Cans of SpaghettiOs and pork and beans stood in neat rows beside Kraft macaroni and cheese, Jiffy Pop, hot dog buns, bread. In the icebox he found hot dogs, ketchup, mustard, relish, 2 six-packs of beer. He grabbed all the hot dogs, then, thinking better of it, put one package back. He set out the cans of SpaghettiOs and pork and beans. He rifled the drawers and slipped a can opener into his back pocket. Then he lost patience. He'd gathered up the loot and was heading for the back door when something on the formica table caught his eye. The pepper cow stood atop a white mimeographed page, titled in big blue letters. He could only see the first half. Runner. Awkwardly, he set down the food and slipped the sheet from under the newspaper. The pleasant odor of mimeograph fluid rose off the paper. There was a poorly reproduced photograph from the school yearbook, and beneath it a short notice. Runaway. Edgar Sawtell disappeared June 18th. Age 14, height 5 feet 6 inches, black hair. Boy cannot speak, though he may use written notes or sign language. He may be accompanied by one or more dogs. Last seen wearing blue jeans, sneakers, and a brown and red checkered short-sleeve shirt near Mellon. Before he could finish reading, he heard a bark from the direction of the woods. He stuffed the notice in his pocket and scooped up the canned goods and wieners. Outside, he had to dump everything on the ground again to reach through the ripped screen and set the hook into the eye. Then he smoothed the screen into place as best he could, gathered up the food, and ran across the gravel road. Essay stood waiting a few feet inside the edge of the woods, Tinder and Babu not far behind. He put them all in downstays, sternly, then turned and fumbled with a can opener. He poured SpaghettiOs into 3 widely separated piles. The dogs moaned. He signed a release and they pounced, and the SpaghettiOs were gone. But he was already ripping open the wieners and stuffing one into his mouth and handing them out to the dogs. Then he came to his senses. Somewhere he'd read that people who tried to eat after long stretches without food threw it up, though he felt in no danger of that himself, only a comforting sensation in his middle. Probably that wisdom had been written by the same person who could survive for a month without food. They had lasted 3 days. But it would be foolish not to wait a few minutes just to be sure. The dogs scoured the ground where the SpaghettiOs had so briefly lain, while Edgar counted out 100 breaths. The wieners were salty. They made him thirsty, but that was okay. That was just fine. He picked up the remaining food and retreated to a clearing out of sight of the cabins. It was the friendliest-looking place he'd seen in days. He sat down Indian style while the dogs gathered around him, transfixed. And like a magician performing sleight of hand, he began working the opener over a can of pork and beans. Pirates. By then they'd been going for 10 days, maybe more. Edgar had started to lose track. And over that time, they'd come to a new set of accommodations for how to be together. He had no tackle with him, no leads, no collars, no long lines, no ground rings. None of the means they'd had at the kennel to agree about what mattered, the ways to stop and start, when to stay close and when to explore, how to attend one another. He had few rewards to give, some days not even food, though that happened less often after the first week, after they learned to work the cabins. And so, by necessity, he began to watch the dogs more closely, stop more often, touch them more sweetly and more carefully than he ever had before. And the dogs, in turn, discovered that if they waited after he'd asked them to stay and disappeared into a cabin, he would always return. Together they practiced new skills he devised. They had long understood what was being asked of them during a stay, whether in the training yard or in town. Now he asked if they would stay in a forest glade when they were hungry, and the flickers pounded the ground, thumping up millipedes, or squirrels harassed them, or a rock sailed over their heads and rattled the dead leaves. Several times each day he found a likely spot, shielded by sumac or bracken fern, and he placed them in guard over something small, a stick he'd been carrying that morning, say, or a bit of rag. Then he walked off into the forest, careful not to push them past the breaking point, since he had no way to correct them. Later he tied a length of fishing line to the guarded thing and asked them to move only when it moved, keeping it surrounded. When they got that right, he'd sail back into their midst, signing, "Release!" and throw himself at them to roll and tickle, toss the thing for them to catch. See to each of them in whatever way he'd learned was the greatest delight for that dog. He learned, too, the limits of their patience, different for each of them. In a stay, Babu was as immovable as the hills, and likely to fall asleep. Essay, ever alert, was the most tempted of any of them by the skitter of a rock pitched through the ferns. And Tinder, equally likely to stick or bolt, who twice jumped up when Essay broke her stay and licked her muzzle and coaxed her back into a sit. They agreed, more slowly, that running away mattered as much as staying. After some time, he could ask them to find a spot elsewhere and wait. First they ventured only a few feet. Later they ran until he couldn't see them anymore. They agreed it was important not to bark when they needed his attention or when they got excited. They practiced these things many times each day, whenever they tired of breaking trail through the underbrush. He began to link the idea of running away and guarding. He put the thing to guard on the ground and walked the dogs away from it, then made them return, watch it, scoot along with it as it jerked through the dead leaves on its string. He spent long evening hours picking through their coats for ticks and burrs. He checked their feet 100 times each day. And he compromised his idea of their destiny in order to live. They could make only as much progress as food allowed. What point was there in bolting northward if they starved halfway to wherever he intended to go? They had to pick a route that kept them hidden and let them harvest food. That meant a pace slower and a route more circuitous than he'd imagined. He became an expert burglar of vacation cottages and fishing shacks. Mornings, while the campers fried bacon and flipped pancakes, he and the dogs lingered in the weeds. Later, those same cabins would stand empty, ripe for plundering. He learned to enter without breaking, and always left without taking enough to be noticed. He carried few supplies, and none that would tie him down. a can opener, and a jackknife, and later, when their diet made his teeth and gums feel buzzy, a toothbrush. A child's Zebco spin-casting rod, small enough to carry through the woods. A fisherman's satchel with a bobber and some hooks set in a piece of cardboard. With a little skill, he provided for them all. Panfish, mainly, but sometimes a bass or a bullhead, too. Plenty of nights they went to sleep hungry, but seldom starving. The cabins yielded Twinkies and Suzy Q's and ho-hos by the armful, deviled ham and custard pies and corn chips and peanut butter to eat straight from the jar. Handfuls of Wheaties and Cap'n Crunch washed down with soda, and an endless procession of wieners and salami and sardines and Hershey bars. Occasionally, he even found dog food, which the dogs gobbled from his palm like the most uncommon delicacy. And he stole off that balm of peace and contentment, that ambrosia of the skin, heavenly, wonderful, miraculous off. Above all, the deep woods variety, whose bitter flavor and greasy viscosity came to signify something as essential as food or water. A day unmauled by deer flies, a night of refuge from mosquitoes. He stole it from every cabin he tiptoed through, all of it, remorselessly. Wherever they spent more than a day, he hoarded two or three of the white and orange aerosols and a batch of Bactines as well. Rainy days were hard. Sometimes there was no better shelter than the base of a thick jackpine, and if the wind blew, that could be no shelter at all. Rainy nights were torture, great racking storms with lightning exploding all around. If he looked into the strobed rain too long, he ended up curled and oblivious. For if there was no figure to be seen in the falling drops of water, he felt abandoned. And if he saw anything, a shape, a movement, a form, he screamed silently, despite all resolution to the contrary. Other dogs were a problem. Idiot dogs that, having scented them, loped into the woods, disregarding the cries of their owners to come back, come home, come play. Some trundled along like clowns, others looking for trouble like snipers. Babu especially took umbrage, and he led his littermates in savage charges, ignoring Edgar's protests until the marauders ran howling away. They drifted from lake to lake, like stepping stones across a creek, moving westward through the Shawamigan. Sometimes Edgar learned the names of the lakes from leaflets inside the cabins, Phoebus, Duckhead, Yellow, but usually it was just the lake. Without maps, they found themselves hemmed in by marshes and forced to backtrack. The dogs had long since grown expert at finding turtle eggs. One or the other would suddenly track down and run along a tangent and start to dig. The eggs ripened and grew ever more disgusting, apparently in equal proportion to their delicacy. But Edgar helped with the digging and pocketed a few for later as rewards. He tromped along the rushes at shorelines until frogs leapt toward the waiting dogs, who pounced and munched. He stole matches whenever he spotted them. During the day he wouldn't build fires, wary of smoke-watching rangers and towers, but at night he allowed himself small yellow cook fires, kindling them with papery curls of birch bark. After he tamped them out with dirt, he and the dogs slept, listening to the yips and moans of beavers. At daybreak, loons cried. The lake was named Scotia, and the 4th of July holiday had brought campers in such droves that Edgar and the dogs were forced to retreat far from the cabins and campsites. Though he couldn't be sure exactly which night the 4th itself would fall on, firecrackers had been popping for 3 nights running. He'd moved them down near the lake, into the woods across the water from a small campground. He picked a spot well inland and was preparing to light a little pyramid of sticks and birch bark when a barrage of husky whistles came across the water. He turned to see red trailers in the air, followed by 3 loud whomps. He led the dogs to the water and onto a spit of land occupied by a pine grove, and they sat. The sky was filled with sculpted clouds, stars blazing in the interstices. A dozen campfires burned in the campground. He heard music and laughter and children's shrieks. Silhouettes ran between the fires and the lake, whipping hairy sparklers through the air. A fiery beetle skittered across the beach, crackling and sparkling. Another round of rockets lifted over the water. A string of firecrackers crackled. Single and double flowers blossomed, big as moons, and in the aftermath red and blue particles showered down, reflections rising from the water to extinguish them in the meeting. The dogs sat on their haunches, watching. Esse walked the lake's edge to nose one of the spirit embers, then turned and nuzzled Edgar for an explanation. He only sat and watched and lifted a hand to cup her belly. Somewhere a song played on the radio. The campers began to sing, voices quavering over water. A dog howled, followed by a peal of laughter. The dog carried on, voice high and keen. After a while, Tinder lifted his muzzle and howled in response. Esse was up at once, licking his face. When he wouldn't stop, she joined in with her own yik yik yo, and then Babu completed the trio. The camper's dog listened as if considering some proposition and then yodeled again. Edgar knew he should stop them, but he liked the sound. It was lonesome in the woods that night, more than usual, and he couldn't resist some connection, however tenuous, to those people and their festivities. The dogs chorused in rounds, and the campers laughed and joined in until all but Edgar bellowed into the sky. After a while, the dogs fell silent and the campers stopped. For a time, it was quiet. Then, from the hillside north of the lake, where no cabins stood and no campfires burned, there came a basso that ended in a high chatter. Edgar recognized that howl at once, though he'd heard it at the kennel that one night only. A cry of such loneliness, it drove the warmth of the July night into the stars. Esse leapt up, hackles raised, then Babu and Tinder. Edgar set his hands on their backs and guided them down, and he walked out on the wind-scoured cobble and waited. A burst of nervous laughter issued from across the lake. Then slowly all the sounds of the night crept back. The peepers and the crickets and the swish of the wind in the trees, and from farther away the rumble of heat lightning and the eerie calls of owls and nightingales and whippoorwills. But the howl had come only once and would not again. He dreamed that night of Almandine, her gaze unflinching, seeking the answer to some question. It woke him in the dark. When he returned to sleep, she was there again. He woke in the morning desolate and weary, dwelling on the things he missed. He missed the morning chores and the simplicity of breakfast at a table. He missed television, the afternoon movie on WEAU, the softness of their lawn. Second only to Almandine, he missed words, the sound of his mother's voice, and the new Webster Encyclopedic Dictionary of the English language, and reading and signing things out to the pups in the whelping pens. And he woke hungry. He collected the Zebco and the satchel and kicked leaves over the dead coals of the fire, and they traced the lake shore to a spot he'd fished the day before. From the satchel, he pulled one tattered leg of a woman's nylons, rolled up his jeans, and waded barefoot into the lake. He returned with a handful of minnows in his makeshift seine. A few minutes later, he popped a sunfish out of the lake, gutted it, set it aside for the dogs, and threaded another minnow onto the hook. He fed the dogs in turns, making sure each of them had their share, scaling and filleting the flesh from the bones and tossing aside the skeletons. And when he finished, he gave them each two heads to take away and crunch. He himself wouldn't eat the fish raw. To the south was a cottage he'd raided once. If he couldn't get into it now, he would have to wait until he could roast himself fish in the evening. He left the rod and satchel and led the dogs away. When they were close to the cottage, he stayed them and pushed through the undergrowth for a better look. The cottage sat near the lake at the end of a long dirt drive. It was painted bright red, with windows neatly trimmed in white. Two families were toting things to a car. He backtracked to the dogs and waited. He heard the chatter of children's voices, the slam, slam, slam of car doors, and a motor starting. When all was quiet again, he brought the dogs forward and stayed them at the clearing's edge. A second car, a brown sedan with a leatherette-covered roof, sat parked in the weedy yard. There was no sound from the cottage except for a pair of gray squirrels bouncing loudly across the roof. He looked in a window, then knocked at the door. When no one answered, he slid the window up and levered himself onto the sill. A few minutes later, he slipped out, carrying two peanut butter sandwiches, a package of bacon, and a stick of butter. In one back pocket, he had a Hershey's candy bar, and in the other, a bottle of Off. He was passing the car again when he remembered the car keys he'd seen glinting on the countertop inside the cottage. He looked through the driver's side window at the stick shift on the floor, an H pattern engraved on the knob. He didn't think he could drive it, but for a moment he let himself imagine it anyway. Sitting behind the wheel as they sped along a highway, windows down, S.A. up front and Babu and Tinder in the back, their heads out the windows in the streaming summer air. And then what? How far could he get in a stolen car? How would they buy gas? What would they eat? At least the way things were now, though they moved at a crawl, there was food almost every day. With a car, there would be no waiting outside cottages, no stealth. Worst of all, taking a car would destroy the illusion that he and the dogs were long gone. The Forest Service airplane had stopped flying above the treetops a week ago. He hadn't seen police cruisers trolling the roads since that first day. Flyers had stopped appearing in cabins. But someone who steals a car exists. He can be chased, tracked, caught. And even if they took back roads, not that he knew which back roads to take, the four of them would be a spectacle. Taking a car meant stepping out of their phantom existence and back into the real world. He trudged back to where the dogs lay, stretched out and panting. He sat and fed them strips of bacon and squeezed the stick of butter into pats they could lick from the platform of his fist. Afterward, they hounded him for his peanut butter sandwiches. "Get lost," he signed. He turned around and around, then relented and pinched off a corner for each, requiring each to do some small thing, lie down, fetch a stick, roll over and show their belly to the sky. But he kept the Hershey's bar for himself, broken and softened and melted to pudding by body heat. When he'd licked his fingers clean, he set off for a place he had in mind to sleep. The four of them were ensconced in a clearing near